Ci autorizziamo un credito? Sì,
Ah, certo.
assolutamente.
Non mi ricordo qual è una di queste due manca.
Scusa,
una di queste manca, non mi ricordo. Se chiedo a Casini, dove è Casini? Quale manca dei due? Non mi ricordo. Uno dei due manca dei due.
No.
Lorenzo?
No.
Sì, beh, quale manca delle...
Ma forse assume. Scusami, assume.
Ok, aspetta. No, è Assun che manca.
Sì, sì, Nicola Assun. Ma chi manca?
La prima. Ok, I think we should get started because we have still a long session and we are competing with an event which many Italians consider very important, the soccer game, Italy against Croatia at 6 p.m. But I hope that Italian participants won't leave the room before the end. But we have a sort of advantage because one of the speakers is not here today. And so this session is might be a little bit shorter, so because Nicole Hassoum has not come, and but I think that most of the people here have read the paper, and so we could start with the first session with Melanie Sampson, and the topic of her paper and her presentation is indicators as monitoring tool for implementation of global health law. So please take your time. I think we could take 15 minutes so we can cover and thank you very much. Please.
Thank you very much, and thank you for invitation. So there is no denying that the use of indicators is a pervasive phenomenon in the field of global health. Generally speaking, public health is a world inhabited by indicators, as this field relies heavily on evidence-based actions and implies a vast array of statistics and numbers that aim to simplify very complex phenomena. What I'd like to do today in my presentation is to provide a brief survey of the use of indicators within the framework of international health law, and more specifically in the lawmaking activity of WHO. The aim of my paper was to investigate and deconstruct the use of indicators in the purpose of for measuring the compliance with a series of instruments and in global health law, namely the revised International Health Regulations, IHR, which is an exceptional regulatory instrument in international law, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the FCTC, which is a treaty, and the two codes of practice, namely the International Code on the Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes and the more recent Global Code on the International Recruitment of Health Personnel. In fact, each of these instruments makes use of specific indicators in order to measure or to promote the compliance with the actual rules concerned. First, in the context of the revised IHR, 28 indicators have been defined in order to monitor and evaluate the obligation of its Article 5 and Annex 1 to develop and maintain core capacities at the country level in order to respond promptly and effectively to public health risk. These indicators are mostly of a qualitative nature, spelling out, for example, what kind of procedures must be draft and adopt at the country level in order to satisfy a specific obligation. And they specify different levels of completion with each obligation and for each indicators. Second, as for the FCTC, so the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, some guidelines for implementations adopted by the Conference of Parties also provide a number of indicators for monitoring purposes. This is the case, for example, with the guidelines for implementation of Article 8 that contains process and outcome indicators for monitoring purposes. Third, regarding the two codes of practice, an interesting use of indicators is also made by NGOs. In fact, the level of implementation with the codes themselves are considered as an indicator for the implementation, the level of implementation of water public health strategies. Going beyond the plurality and diversity of these indicators, one can single out three interesting aspects regarding the relationship between law and indicators, namely their non-creating value, their science-based legitimacy, and also the fact that they function as a bridge between various actors. Regarding first the non-creating value of indicators, one of the features of indicators is that they tend to complement the actual rules. In other words, indicators do not merely amount to interpretation, but they give flesh to the rule in providing the exact operational means to implement the obligation. This is particularly the case with the IHR or indicators that provide the specifics of a correct implementation of core capacities by the various stakeholders of disease surveillance. Also, some FCTC guidelines, so the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, provide for indicators that do not limit themselves to interpretation, but seems to add to the obligations. An apt illustration is provided by Article 8 of the FCTC, which requires the adoption of measures to protect people from exposure to tobacco smoke in public places, in workplaces, and in public transportation. However, although this provision doesn't extend to private places, one of the outcome indicators designated in the guidelines is the reduction in percentage in exposure to second-hand tobacco smoke in private homes. It seems here that the indicator is not only interpretative, but clearly adds an element to the interpretation of Article 8. If we take into account the tendency of states to engage in a race to indicators, these additions or complements to the obligations provided by indicators have a real normative value and have a concrete impact on all the rules are implemented. Then, while technically non-binding, indicators nonetheless benefit from a science-based legitimacy. More precisely, the fact that indicators are defined by experts and are thought to reflect best practices clearly enhance not only their legitimacy, but also their authority amongst public health actors and also policymakers. Finally, indicators build a bridge between actors. In the various instruments, indicators seem to be used as a cooperation tool. From this perspective, the IHR indicators are interesting in two respects. First, the checklist of indicators is perceived as a trust-building tool between WHO and its members. Those countries that were not able to reach the levels 1 and 2 of the indicators by June 2012 will develop implementation plans based on these indicators and will be able to seek advice and recommendation from WHO. It seems here that the uptake of indicators is a very valuable tool to operationalize the initial obligation of the IHR and to initiate a close monitoring of the implementation. Second, it is explicitly stated in the checklist that indicators could be used by multilateral and bilateral donors in order to target their funding and to measure the performance of recipient countries in using funds dedicated to disease surveillance. In fact, the World Bank, for example, that has granted important loans and credits to developing countries in this field, recognize explicitly that the funds intend to facilitate the compliance with the IHR obligations. As such, there is every reason to believe that the indicators will be used by international donors to condition and evaluate this kind of projects. In conclusion, it is clear here that indicators are prominent features of global health law. This doesn't mean that indicators don't raise any problem. More transparency may be needed, and the multiplication of indicators may require some coordination. However, beyond the diversity of their use and the actors involved, it seems that they play an interstitial role in global health governance, in building bridges not only between law and measurement tools, but also between the two cultures of public health, policymakers and lawyers, and between the multiple actors of global health governance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you made us save a lot of time in your presentation. And I think that now we should move to the discussant, Gianluca Burci, please. Thank you.
Thank you. And considering the start at 6 of Italy-Croatia, we'll also try to be extremely time conscious. First of all, as a practitioner, I feel a bit intimidated, of course, not only because, like Professor Battini before me, I'm a neophyte in indicators, which can be a bit paradoxical since WHO is a massive producer and user of indicators, but also I'm more of a practitioner, not an academic, so I was very impressed by the theoretical complexity of the issue of indicators. So what I'm going to do is to make some observations on the two papers that I was asked to discuss, and it's a pity that Nicole Hassoun couldn't be here because she had a very interesting paper. And maybe expand it a little bit in the practice of WHO and the use of indicator in global health governance. First of all, I think it is evident that the increasing complexity of public health at the international level and of international health law. That's because of the increasing political profile of health, of the growing and challenging interactions between health and many other areas of international law, and also the growing complexity and fragmentation of governance at the international level in the field of public health. Consequently, also the use of indicators or targets or benchmarks by the public health community, not only by WHO but by many other actors, has become more controversial, more political, and I think there is a growing appreciation of the governance and political implications of the indicators that we use. And the two papers that I've asked to discuss are, I think, exemplary of this complexity and of the shifting purposes, uses, impacts, and, if you want, communities that rotate around public health indicators. Nicola Soon's paper, even though she's not here, I would like just to refer to it, proposes a fairly complex mathematical model to rank pharmaceutical companies concerning the health impact of the products and to attach, in a way, a reward for companies whose product have a particular significant public health impact. And that addresses one of the main challenges of public health today, which is the inability of the market to generate research and development for so-called neglected diseases, for diseases of poor countries where pharmaceutical companies don't see enough return to justify the big investment in research and development upfront. And equally, the challenge of access to essential medicines. And here, if you look at the health politics today, there are two main approaches. One, if you want, is a promotional market-based approach. Let's try to create push-pull mechanism to make it more appealing for companies to invest money in neglected diseases. The other is a more regulatory approach. Let's accept that the market has failed, and let's impose some regulations on the areas where the market has failed. So you can imagine that in this environment, which is very divisive politically, the value, the meaning, the implications of indicators of health impact of pharmaceutical products, of access, of affordability of medicines, are extremely political and extremely divisive. Nicola Soon's paper proposed, as I said, like a market-based reward system, which I think may be promising, but requires a lot of analysis in terms of the complexity of the pharmaceutical market, in terms of the complexity of the measurement of the need for a medicine, the access to a medicine, the health impact of a medicine, and so on. And that's clearly reflected in the political debates today. Melanie Samson's paper also, I think, with the examples that she had chosen, exemplifies pretty well the other complex variables in the use of indicator. In particular, the shift, which is very evident in public health today, from technical scientific indicators into political indicators to measure certain variables of public health. If I can just mention, refer to the examples that she has made. One is she has referred to the international health regulations, which is one of the very few international binding instruments that WHO has produced. And that it's it's a successor of the old sanitary convention that was supposed to control the spread of epidemic diseases. And one of the main obligations, as Melanie has said, is every country needs to have certain capacities to detect and control diseases, because we are as strong as the weakest link in the international community. But that I find interesting in what Melanie said. She saw there is a system of assessment of these capacities, which is actually the deadline to achieve these capacities now is in June 2012. And countries can have a sort of a grace period if they haven't been able to achieve that. And the Secretariat of WHO, together with certain scientific groups with a very scientific approach to the production of benchmarks and indicators, has produced some tools to help countries in assess this capacity. But it's interesting that Melanie sees this as a form of assessment of compliance, as a form of enforcement of the obligations under the regulations. Whereas from a WHO perspective, we see it very much as a guidance, as a help to states parties to do a self-assessment. So we see it as missing this element of accountability, this element of enforcement. Which makes me think that sometimes the perception of the purpose of the value of an indicator always also changes depending from the perspective from which you look at that indicator. We look from inside the institution as opposed to looking from outside. So we see the same normative framework in different ways. And I found a pretty interesting observation. The second, she mentioned our only treaty in 65 years, not a terribly bright achievement in international law, but this framework convention on tobacco control. Being a framework convention has fairly broad obligations, and the parties to the convention have been very busy adopting guidelines to spell out the obligations, to give guidance for the interpretation of this obligation, once again, to give tools for a self-assessment by parties, to create some accountability in link to the reporting mechanism to the conference of the parties, but also, it's very evident, to create a tools for advocacy and mobilization. I think the example that Melanie gave is very good of the indoor smoking, which is not in the convention, it goes beyond. And there is clearly, when you talk about the community that produces the indicator, a strong impact by an NGO lobby, very aggressive, very prompt advocacy that sees these guidelines also as tools for advocacy, as tools to also mobilize against the tobacco industry. So once again, you see the potential complex uses of these indicators. And it's interesting that one of these indicators concerning the regulation of tobacco products has been used by the appellate body of the WTO in a very recent case between Indonesia and the United States concerning the ban on import of flavored cigarettes. And neither Indonesia nor the United States are parties to the convention. Nonetheless, the appellate body has used these guidelines as an indicator of what is a like product under the Agreement on Technical Barriers to Trade. So once again, it's interesting when you talk about the technical credibility and legitimacy of certain, the perception of legitimacy of certain indicators that can carry effect outside normally the formal scope of their applicability. Finally, Melanie mentioned our non-binding codes. The main example being an old code on the marketing of breast milk substitutes that came out of a very bitter struggle between the food industry, in particular Nestlé, and very, once again, aggressive NGOs that, maybe because of the soft nature of this code, broadens the community to which it is directed and gives, for example, NGOs a direct watchdog role. And so, and I like the observation that Melanie makes in the paper, the code itself has become an indicator for the implementation of different policies, like the implementation of the right to food, WHO strategy on child nutrition, and so on. So the code of marketing contains indicator, but it becomes in its own right an indicator in a sort of several layers of assessment and, once again, civil society mobilization. I would like to conclude, generalizing from what the two papers said, would like to conclude with some observations on I think, main trend, main issues on the use of indicators in global health. And I think they follow up on some of the observations made earlier. First of all, a very clearly visible in WHO, as I said before, a shift from scientific technical indicator to political indicators. The ethos of WHO has always been, let scientists, independent scientists, be the ones who set up indicators, because they can ensure legitimacy, an absence of conflict of interest, scientific credibility of the indicator, that in a way will give additional normative and accountability impact to the indicator. As soon as WHO steps out of the historical core of communicable diseases, politicization increases and the political values of the indicators increase. Right now, there is a very difficult process in motion of setting indicators for the measurement of progress in the control of non-communicable diseases. And that's something that impacts very directly food industry and a number of other industrial sectors. And member states are clearly taking the lead in setting up these indicators. So in a way, you trade off what we saw was the scientific accuracy and legitimacy indicators with political realism and simplification of the indicator that will be non-binding indicators that should be used by stakeholders. So once again, it's important to assess this trade-off. When you talk about scientific indicators, there's a point that has not been touched before, and that's very visible in WHO, and it's the issue of conflict of interest. Because normative indicators, in my view, in the view of many, are credible if there is a perception that they are not tainted by a conflict of interest, that they are not being set up, influenced by the community which will be impacted by these indicators. And that's, I think, an important value that maybe can be discussed later on during this conference. The final comment is indicators in a way reflect the governance systems in which they are located. As I said, public health is in a way characterized by growing complexity and fragmentation. There is a growing number of agencies, but also of new initiatives, what we call public-private partnerships, that exercise considerable political and normative weight. And very often, they generate their own indicators, in particular when they are financial instruments. They give financial grants to developing countries. And so you see a proliferation of indicators that sometimes have a distorting effect on the countries to which they are addressed. For example, focusing too much attention on certain diseases and ignoring more horizontal issues by attracting more human resources in certain areas and neglecting others. So in a way here you see the less benign side of development and public health indicators. It's interesting that there is the only redressing approach to correct these distortions is within the community that produces indicators, is within these agencies, these partnerships, these initiatives. There is a lack, in my view, of an overarching system, of a more vertical system, to correct the distortion that these indicators can generate. And I think it goes back to what Lorenzo Casini was saying and Professor Cassese on a possible regulation on the indicators. In my view, coordination and regulation, it's something very visible in the international health. I would stop here. It's a pity that Melanie did not talk about the increasing use of indicators to measure the achievement of a right to health. That's very visible. It's implicit in the idea of an economic and social right subject to progressive realization, where you need to measure progress, you need benchmarks and targets and indicators. That's, in a way, trickled in very much in the discourse within WHO. The special rapporteur of the Human Rights Council on the Right to Health has done a lot of work on a human rights approach to health indicators, but that, I think, will take us too far, but it's another area where I think there would be a lot of space for analytical work on the importance, value, and effect of indicators. And I will stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much also for the effort to summarize Nicole Hassoum's paper. And now we quickly move to the second part of our session with the Marta Infantino. Her topic is the law of indicators on women's rights. Please take your time.
Thank you. So in my paper, I tried to use indicator on women's human rights as a case study to highlight a paradox within the field of human rights indicator. Now, the paradox is very well known and has been implicitly referred to by many of the previous speakers. It runs as follows. A common feature of human rights indicators, whatever notion of human rights indicator we may have in mind, is that they measure human rights scores against human rights standards. So in other words, they measure also legal phenomena against legal benchmarks. In light of the indicators, of these indicators' reliance on legal knowledge, one may reasonably expect lawyers to have made substantial contribution to their development, or to have studied in depth the legal implication of their production and use. Yet, nothing would be farther from reality. The current state of the art in the production of use and use of human rights indicator is the result of an ongoing process led by bureaucrats from international and national organizations, development economists, human rights statisticians, and human rights activists with limited or very narrow legal training. It is these actors who are developing a new body of professional knowledge, and it is these actors who are creating a new technology of governance based on knowledge. Lawyers have so far made almost no contribution to these transformations. In the field of human rights indicators, lawyers' absence is particularly striking. Human rights indicators require and transmit knowledge about society's legal cultures. And at the same time, they imply an assessment of what human rights are and of the condition under which human rights are enjoyed or infringed. And to this extent, it's clear to everybody that human rights indicator should require lawyers at ease with both the legal cultures under examination and with the international human rights discourse, which is supposed to be applied to them. Let me be a bit more concrete with regard to indicators on women's human rights. To prepare and use indicators on women's human rights, one should be familiar with the whole range of legal layers which, outside and inside the West, are not captured by positive law, but nevertheless govern people's status in society and women's status in society in particular, determining their intra-family and kinship relationship, determining their access to property rights, or the dispute resolution mechanism that they could turn to. Without familiarity with these layers, one can neither identify the deeply entrenched norms that shape human behavior, nor understand the relevance of these local practices to global human rights standards. Yet, lawyers should not only appropriate the substantive discourse underlying women's human rights indicators and human rights indicators generally. Lawyers are also needed to identify the regulatory patterns of behavior developed by the actors who participate in the initiative about human rights indicators, and to study the accountability principles which apply and should apply to the indicators, producers, and users. And such a study is really badly needed. In the public debate, as well as in the literature about human rights indicators, human rights indicators are often considered as characterized by the same feature as other, it is non-human rights indicators, and as identical one to the other. Yet the world of human rights indicators is very diverse, both with regard to other kind of indicators, of global indicators, and within itself. It is not just that human rights indicators may be universal or regional, general or thematic, based on perception, surveys, or on data, and so on. The point is that human rights indicators, as the case of indicators on women's human rights clearly show, are produced by different actors acting under different sources of constraints and in order to reach different goals. Let me again be more concrete with regard to women's human rights. Indicators about women's human rights differ, first of all, as to the structure of the network of actors who produce and use these indicators. At one extreme, we have institutions which commit themselves to draw indicators on their own human rights performance. And that's the symbiosis between producer and users that Professor Kingsbury referred to. But at the other extremes, we have other indicators where one can distinguish A, the subject who asks for the indicator to be established, B, the subject who prepare the guidelines according to which the indicator should be drafted, C, the subjects who collect and report the information according to which the indicator will be drafted, D, the subject who actually put together all this information and publish the indicator, E, the indicator's expected and effective targets, and F, I suppose, the indicator expected and intended and, I'm sorry, expected and effective users. All these roles may be held by different figures. And of course, between these two extremes, there are many nuances. But it's not only because of their structures that indicators on women's human rights may differ one from the other. Indicators differ also as to the reason of their production and use. Sometimes indicators are prepared outside of any hard or soft legal obligation. Other times, the establishment of and participation in an indicator's endeavor is mandated by some authority. But authority may stem from traditional hard legal obligation, in some case. In other case, authority may arise from institutional arrangements, contractual or quasi-contractual obligation, and still other times authority may take the form of soft invitations and command, whose binding force derives from good practices and institutionalized patterns of behaviors only. But indicators differ also as to their intended human rights indicators and women's and indicators on women's human rights in particular differ also as to their intended and effective uses. Some indicators on women's human rights are expected to be purely informative and simply document situations related with human rights. Other indicators have the goal to help policymakers facilitate the planning of human rights policies or to leverage public opinion against certain state or non-state actors for their behaviors. Yet other times, indicators on women's human rights are prepared to facilitate governmental and non-governmental organizations' monitoring of states' compliance with their own human rights commitment. In other cases, they are established to help donors and financial institutions to control the success of the human rights programs that they have funded. still in other case, they are established to evaluate the overall, for financial institution, to evaluate the overall condition of the prospective beneficiaries of funding as a way both to predict their performance in the future and to predict the prospective beneficiaries of the funding ability to repay the funder. Now, why are these differences relevant? Why it's relevant to understand who produces and uses the indicators, why and what for? And I think that these differences, highlighting and understanding these differences, is crucial because different initiatives structured in a different way call for different regulatory disciplines and for different accountability standards. Understanding the distribution of power within the network of entities which contribute to the production of an indicator and assessing the reason why these entities participate in the indicator's endeavor and what for is essential to understand the regulatory environment in which these actors operate and the extent of freedom and responsibility which is and should be given to them. But this is an opportunity that, with regard to human rights indicator, lawyers so far have missed. So to sum up, I think there is a paradoxical absence of lawyers in the field of human rights indicators. Such absence should be filled at the substantive level by lawyers able to understand both local and global legal cultures, as well as at the procedural level by scholars such as global administrative scholars who are the only ones endowed with skills to study the regulatory patterns and principles which support and should support the production and uses of these indicators. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And then we move to the next paper on the law indicators, the indication of progress assessing the use of indicators in the UN Commissioner for Refugees Cooperations. Please go ahead. Thank you very much.
Yes, well, I'm afraid that this paper is one of the thick description case studies that was referred to by David Nelken earlier. So just in this speech, I'd like to give a brief overview of the turn to indicators within the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and how that fits into a broader turn to indicators in humanitarian agencies, before flagging a few of the critical concerns that we can see in the indicators as they're currently framed by the organisation. But it should be noted that the indicators currently used by UNHCR are, to an extent, in a state of flux at the moment. The organisation is putting into place an indicator system which is not finalised at this stage. So some of these criticisms are criticisms that are also known by the organisation that the organisation is trying to address in its indicator project as it currently stands. So just first to look at the use of indicators within UNHCR, its turn to indicators I think is part of a general enthusiasm on the part of humanitarian agencies to use indicators both to allocate aid within their own budgets as an internal planning tool, but also as a means of providing enhanced accountability to donors and also accountability to beneficiaries of aid. And this is something that comes up in a number of the humanitarian agencies, the sense that indicators can provide accountability to beneficiaries. The organisation has declared a long-term vision of establishing and systematically using indicators for planning and measuring the impact of its operations and has referred to them as a global yardstick by which it can objectively compare different populations of concern. And it should be noted that UNHCR does have an extremely complex and substantial workload. It currently considers 36 million people to fall within its mandate as persons of concern. It works in 125 countries, and it has a level of responsibility for 111 refugee camps worldwide. And so one of these sets of indicators is entirely for use within different refugee camps to determine the allocation of aid in those camps. So the Standards and Indicators Initiative was launched by UNHCR in 2002, and it has since published a practical guide on standards and indicators, which details a how-to guide for staff collecting data on 154 separate indicators. And it's currently developing a results framework, which is intended to replace the practical guide, but this is as of yet an internal document, and so most of the information in this speech comes from the practical guide. And in terms of the structure of the indicators, I think it's important to note that they're internally generated indicators, where data is collected by staff themselves and is used for internal planning. So when the data is released in annual reports, for example, or other reports, it tends not to be rank ordered in the way that you would usually expect from indicators. So data is released publicly either alphabetically or in an aggregate fashion where you refer to 91 states as having fulfilled a particular target, but not actually state who those states are. And this is due, I think, to the delicate relationships that UNHCR has with the countries in which it works, but I would argue doesn't stop these from being considered indicators, given that they are measures of comparison within the organisation. Looking at the indicators that are actually used, I believe that the indicator model as it currently stands has a number of serious weaknesses. And I also think that given the complexity of their organisations, some level of quantitative analysis is necessary, and that these difficulties can be amended to some extent. And the four key problems that I outline in the paper are first structural flaws in the indicators, which tend to be quite closely aligned to the kind of flaws that are suggested in framing papers for this topic. Second, methodological concerns, given the burden of data collection pragmatically on staff. Third, concerns in the use of indicators and their potential to stymie innovative policy within the organisation, and that's something the organisation has recognised. And fourth, a problem of trying to be responsive to too many different actors simultaneously through the same tools, and a question of whether it is actually possible to provide accountability across the board in the way that UNHCR intends. So in terms of the structural flaws, I won't go into these in great details, but they concern things such as inadequate proxies that are somewhat divorced from what is actually being measured, calls for binary yes-no answers to extremely complex questions, misleading or ambiguous titles to the indicator, so it's not clear what is actually being measured. And in particular, some indicators don't make it clear whether they are de jure indicators measuring legislative frameworks or whether they're measuring practical situations on the ground, and also calls for judgments on vague and subjective standards. And to give just one example of this last concern, refugee camp indicator 53 is a call for the percentage of households with adequate dwellings within the camp. And in the words of one UNHCR staff member, is an adequate dwelling in Somalia the same as an adequate dwelling in Serbia? There's simply no guidance on how you can actually create a comparative analysis out of such a subjective term that applies so differently in different regional settings. So moving away from those structural problems in the indicators, there's then the burden of data collection. And I think that in a lot of humanitarian agencies, there's been a tremendous enthusiasm towards indicators at the point of framing, and this is followed by some self-criticism at the point of data collection, when the burdens of actually creating a useful indicator become clear. And as an example, there are 71 indicators measured in camp situations, 49 annually, 6 biannually, 1 quarterly, 10 monthly, and 4 on the basis of food distribution cycles or seasonal requirements. And all these indicators are meant to be collected by staff members of UNHCR on top of their existing duties. And when you consider the vast numbers of people that these staff are responsible for, the difficulties become quite obvious. And I think that there are two possible outcomes from an institutional perspective to this. One is that data collection becomes the primary task of field workers, such that other qualitative means of gaining information is cast aside. The other is information overload, that the data simply becomes unmanageable and hence ignored. And this is also an institutional problem, I think, when internally generated indicators are looked at. The third quick point I'd like to raise is the policy concerns when too much pressure is placed on indicators within an organisation. One of the risks perceived by UNHCR staff is that by focusing on outcomes that are relatively easy to measure, they may be paying less attention across the board to equally or more important outcomes that require different assessment methods. So as an example, focusing on making sure that students are enrolled in classes as opposed to the quality of the education that they're receiving, which may be far more difficult to get a quantitative analysis of. And my final point, just before I finish, is this question of providing accountability to multiple stakeholders simultaneously. UNHCR does see this as being a mode of accountability both to donors and to refugees themselves. And the way that they see this is that the indicators are a participatory exercise, which is part of a rights-based approach of the organisation. And I think that this approach is not particularly compelling, because the statement begs the questions of how exactly beneficiaries participate in the framing of indicators. And in the case of UNHCR, refugees aren't involved at the level of framing in indicators, but rather at the point of data collection. And so, for example, in an urban programming indicator, it's decided that youth and adolescents themselves can be trained to collect information on the number of 15 to 24-year-olds involved in vocational and skills training. And this is presented as one of the ways that beneficiaries can be involved in indicators and hence be held accountable through them. And I think that this has been raised, particularly by Professor Satterthwaite in other humanitarian agencies, as a problem, attempting to give accountability to beneficiaries. And in this framework, further thought needs to be put towards the kind of participation envisaged for beneficiaries in human rights oriented indicators to ensure that they do not become relegated to the position of cogs in a preconceived system that they cannot challenge. And I might leave the presentation there.
Thank you very much. We now move to the discussion. Please, Mr. Fisher, take your time.
Thank you. I want to thank Marta and Emma for their rich papers, which I very much enjoyed and learned a great deal from. So I'll begin with Marta's paper, which is a broad critique of indicators, and particularly, as you've heard, of the absence of a comparative and global administrative lawyers in the development of indicators and in the study of legal implications of their use. Marta's main argument is that since indicators, in particular human rights indicators, entail assessments of domestic legal regimes based on a global legal norm, comparative lawyers are needed to understand the translation between local and global, and GAL lawyers are needed to understand the administrative culture of indicators. Marta notes that lawyers can, and I quote, identify against local backgrounds the deeply entrenched norms and practices that shape human relations and influence behavior and choices, refine human rights standards within local contexts, and interpret them in light of local cultural standpoints. Now, I'm mindful of saying this in a room full of lawyers, but I think this may overestimate what we can contribute. I think as lawyers, we're very good at understanding formal legal systems, but maybe less good at knowing informal norms that are often more prevalent in the local context. Our translations thus may be skewed towards formal legal regimes because we're often excluded from the informal ones. Consider, consider the example used in the paper of the Fijian practice of bulu-bulu. The conditions and mechanics of of bulu-bulu as an informal practice of dispute resolution may in fact elude lawyers, because they are excluded both from the process by which the practice is evolving and from its implementation. Marta criticizes CEDAW negotiators for misunderstanding the full complexities of the practice, leading them to condemn the practice wholesale, and argues that had comparative lawyers been present, this misunderstanding would not have occurred. Yet it's not clear that comparative lawyers would in fact be any better in converting the local to global and vice versa than anthropologists or even members of the local NGOs who may be a lot more familiar with the practice and conditions under which the practice amounts to violence against women as opposed to more benevolent instances. Also, to conduct the kind of study that you're proposing in relation to the complicated networks that are involved in the production of human rights indicators actually entails engaging in empirical work, something that traditionally lawyers have not been engaged in, although increasingly they are starting to. A second point about the absence of lawyers is that in some cases they're not absent, they're just merely invisible. And in others, their absence may be intentional. For example, the production of indicators of compliance with human rights treaties necessarily involves legal choices made by producers, whether they're international organizations or state or private bodies. But those choices and the debate surrounding them is obscured by the indicator. But this may in fact be one of the reasons that different actors, including states, may prefer indicators of compliance to other alternatives. For example, state reports of compliance with human rights, where those legal choices and the debate around them is more evident. State reports receive a lot of scrutiny and questioning of their legal choices. On the other hand, to the extent that indicators receive scrutiny, it usually revolves around quality of data questions rather than on the policy or legal choices underlying the indicators. In other words, actors may prefer indicators precisely because they make lawyers and the legal debate invisible. Indicators may also be appealing over other technologies of governance, including laws, because they simplify not just the information, but also the process. So again, if we look at the alternative to human rights indicators, such as state reports on compliance with a particular treaty are filled with legal intricacies and often reflect careful finagling by government lawyers to justify the legality of a particular practice or an act. A state report is often accompanied by an NGO shadow report, which too is often written by lawyers. Exposing nuances of legal interpretations and misinterpretations may be effective for shaming a country that prides itself on strict adherence to international laws or rule of law more broadly, but may make it poor advocacy strategy if you're aiming at mobilizing citizens to put pressure on the government. In contrast, an indicator already subsumes the legal debate within it. It presents its audience with an agreed-upon outcome of that debate. This practice violates this right. In some instances, this is a much more effective advocacy tool. In other words, I think to understand what contributions lawyers can make, it is important to understand why and when indicators are used, what their alternatives are, and what governs a choice to produce or use an indicator over its alternative, because I think the extent of lawyers' contribution will vary along these dimensions. And this brings me to Emma's paper, which is a more detailed study of indicators produced by UNHCR. Emma identifies four concerns, which she just outlined. And she notes that some of these concerns can be addressed and improved upon, while others are either difficult to rectify or inherent in the use of indicators as an operational tool. Now, this may not be part of Emma's project, but this left me wondering, what are the implications of the inherent concerns? I recognize that Emma's paper is not a normative one, and I'm not suggesting that it should be, but it might be interesting to contemplate what an audience, which presumably includes UNHCR, might take from the paper. Quotes in the paper suggest to us that to a certain degree, UNHCR staffers may already be aware of the limitations surrounding the use of indicators. Even at the higher level, there appears to be a recognition of indicators' limits, since the practical guide, which is at the core of Emma's analysis, and which is presumably produced at the head office, itself states that indicators are intended to be complemented with additional information from qualitative indicators, detailed data, and various narrative reports. So why is it that the organization is continuing to use indicators even though it knows its limits? Is it that even though they recognize some limitations but don't understand their full impact? Or are there pressures and tensions within the institution itself, for example, between head office and field staffers, or between staffers in different field locations, that influence both the choice between indicators and alternatives and the kind of indicators that are produced and how they're used? What are the roles of donors? How does the production and use of indicators shape and are shaped by UNHCR's relationship with other international organizations? Is there a contestation of UNHCR's indicators, and are there attempts by NGOs to produce alternatives? And going back to the question posed by Marta's papers, what is the role of lawyers? Why are we as lawyers interested in indicators? As many have pointed out, indicators are not new. Archaeologists use them, as Lorenzo mentioned. Indicators are at the heart of hard science fields, medicine, economics, among others. And often their use in those fields has very similar behavior-changing effects that we've been discussing here. Last week at the Law and Society Conference, Annalise Rice pointedly noted that we are operating in the assumption that indicators mask things, and we, the lawyers, are unmasking them. But perhaps these things are masked to us because this is an unfamiliar technology that it's making its way into our field and pushes our boundaries of comfort. And in this context, the question I want to leave my comments with is, what is the role of us what is our role as lawyers in the in contributing to the growing power of these indicators.
Excellent. We are almost on time for what I leave you to understand, but we can start our discussion and we have some time to for the discussion. So please, I cannot read the names so far, so I'm away. So please, if somebody wants to intervene, please state the name also. Is anybody who wants to? Everybody's tired. We might start with some reactions from the authors of the papers to the. Do you want to maybe say something more, or also?
Marta,
you start.
Thank you for your comments, and I perfectly agree that in order to understand what contribution lawyers can make to the work, to the study of indicators and indicators on human rights in particular, it's necessary to understand why and when indicators are used. But it's exactly because of that that we need global administrative lawyer to understand why and when indicators are used. So I was not arguing that global administrative lawyers should be more present in the process of making the indicators, because I understand you're perfectly right that many times lawyers' invisibility is a strategical choice. But I also agree with what Christian Arndt said this morning, that there is the need for academia to debate frameworks. There is the need for somebody to study indicators, and this need is for lawyers, because indicators have a deep legal implications on the life of states, of organization, and of people. That's about the global administrative lawyers part. As about the comparative lawyers, I agree with you that most of the times lawyers are not equipped with what I was looking for, and it's true that the bulu-bulu practice, the mistake of the committee was discovered by an anthropologist, Stanley Engelmary, not by a lawyer. That's true. But there are lawyers who have the skills to understand what informal law is. It's true that the majority of lawyers are nurtured into a positivistic culture, but still there is someone who have the anthropological training that is needed to really get into what law is in reality, what we usually call informal law is. So, maybe I'm overestimating comparative lawyers, but I'm quite sure that they can make it. That's all.
Okay. Do you want to, please, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to react to the point that was raised about contestation regarding the use of indicators within UNHCR, and I think that is very much happening, that indicators are seen as being particularly beneficial at the headquarters level and is something that donors are particularly pushing for in the organisation. But there's a lot of pushback at the field level from the people that are actually responsible for delivering on the data and collecting the data. And I think that this problem is what's actually pushing the organisation forward and will have a great effect on the way that it changes its indicator process. And I think one of the major things that it may do is to draw back to the kind of indicators that really are susceptible to quantitative analysis and move away from more qualitative questions that they're currently trying to address under indicators that may be too subjective. Also, I just thought I'd respond briefly to the question of what governs the choice of indicators over other measures. In UNHCR, I do believe that there are a number of different measures that are currently being used simultaneously, but when the indicators process was first put together, there was almost a fetish for trying to make indicators responsive to every problem that was available. And now, having got the first lot of data, they've realised that it becomes a bit incomprehensible when you're trying to compare such diverse situations. And also, the quantitative data coming back has to be accompanied by qualitative information to explain the data, which just leads to a proliferation of information. And I think this too will lead to a reduction in the number of indicators that the organisation is looking at, and more of a recognition that qualitative and quantitative data can stand side by side.
Thank you. Maybe also Melanie Sampson wish to, no reaction. Are there any But okay, we start one and two and on the other side, please.
So thank you. So I'm trying to puzzle a little bit in a way about some of the questions that were posed both by Benedict and by Sabina Cassese in light of these papers, because I think what's emerging from this second session is a sort of a deep sense of the complexity of the relationship between numbers and law. I was struck by Professor Cassese's fairly robust defense of the need for better information through numbers as a means of enhancing democratic accountability and improving governance. And that, in a sense, captures a deep imperative which has been with us for a long time, I think, since the birth of modern state bureaucracy, which is that governance is facilitated through better knowledge, that standardizing and regularizing the means of collecting and distributing knowledge improve governance. And that imperative is still with us. What's striking, I think, about the contexts that we've seen in the last session is the complexity of that relationship between governance and knowledge. One is that sometimes these forms of numerical knowledge become embedded in law as hard targets, and they become switches, as it were, which determine legal or illegal entitlement or non-entitlement. But there's another way in which they start to stand in for the norm itself. And I was very struck by the comments by the legal director of the WHO about the ways in which non-binding indicators and measures have become the basis for informing the construction of a legal standard through interpretation, which would suggest that the relationship between law and numbers is in the opposite direction, that the numbers become the standard, but often through hermeneutic legal techniques. So this is a complexity to me, because you have a non-binding standard that becomes binding not through direct appropriation, but through a method of interpretation. And increasingly, this is connected, it seems to me, by problematics of governance. How do you govern at a global scale in the absence of decisive and clear norms, but where you have lots of information? And in what ways does the information become the conduit for governance, the generation of the information and the application of the information? This to me is complicated. It complicates, I think, the question of regulation deeply, because in the assumption of regulation, the assumption is that there are some somewhat relatively vertical power relationships in which one should control and manage the construction of the information to ensure accountability. But I think something that's emerging out of this these discussions is that actually the way in which numbers and indicators are used does not reflect this kind of linearity, that it's they're used as substitutes, as placeholders, as rules of thumb, where agreement can't otherwise be reached, and yet they concretize new standards in complex ways. And I think that makes the idea of regulation and management infinitely more complex.
So please, go ahead.
Thank you. Matthias Goldman again. I don't want to deprive you of the game for too long, so I'll try to be unusually short, and I can be so because my question goes in a similar direction as Nihal's. My question is to Emma. Emma, if I understand your paper correctly, you seem to imply that those indicators first and foremost relate to the activities of UNHCR itself, to its operations, and that's what they were originally developed. But my question is does it really end here? Or is this, to some extent, the beginning of a global codification of or spelling out a code of conduct towards refugees on a global level? I think as UNHCR is present in so many jurisdictions, it might also have an impact on what happens just on a purely national level. For example, refugee status determination is also very often done by UNHCR still on the national level, even though they're not compliant and not forced to accept that. They just accept it. So once there's a standard, it applies to everybody.
Ways? Ah, no, yeah, I'm sorry, I was listening to the...
Can I?
Gustav, please.
So what I found, I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. Please.
Thank you. What I found interesting over this last case is that one really starts saying two aspects of the role of indicators. On one hand is what we have been discussing before of this perhaps vertical role of indicators, so as a technology of global governance. But then from both the cases that we discussed here, but especially from Marta's paper, indicators also play a horizontal role that allows for comparison of entities that are at the same level. So, and I think that that makes interesting the way we think about the possible regulation of indicators. So on one hand, you have this vertical aspect of indicators, so the way in which global institutions use indicators to relate with, let's say, domestic or state actors, and also indicators seem to be useful for being able to understand, which is something that Nihal referred to in his comments at the beginning, which is also it allows for viable comparison. So there is a horizontal aspect to global governance through indicators. So in a way, indicators also contribute to the diversity department of global governance by making it simpler to compare. So it's governance and comparison, or governance and governance through comparison.
Sì, ma deve rispondere.
Just a remark on the point raised by Marta Infantino, saying about the absence of lawyers in the in establishing the indicators. Now, that's a new point that adds, that can complete the range of aspects that need to be deepened, because this morning, we, not really this morning, in the previous session, we were speaking about the distinction between binding, not binding. Now we can say our made indicators, by whom, this is a new point, by whom and for what. Now, for what is a relevant point, because the idea of indicators was born in the social sciences for knowing something, and the idea of indicators is that they can help in knowing better something, and you try, because that's a tentative to try through indicators to catch something. But when we speak in a legal sense of indicators, we refer to the idea of indicators that can shape behaviors, or should be shape behavior. There, the point of who is establishing the indicators is very important, because the idea of forcing behaviors of people, of groups, or nations, of states, can be very important, and the legal sensibility, the idea of putting the idea of a must. Which is typical of a lawyer, is something that is not a natural aspect of an indicator. So I think that there is a lot of space between a descriptive and a normative sense of indicators. And the idea of people who contribute to shape the indicators is very important. But if lawyers are in the sense of doing something that they find in reality, which simply reflects what a certain number of practices do, that's not the ideal sense of law. It's a different sense of law in a factual sense, and this can be a different sense of indicators too. So I need to understand much better all these aspects, for what, by whom, and in what sense.
Thank you. On my left, please, Asta, please.
Thank you. I suppose my question talks to the question that Angelina posed. It means that what is the role of lawyers in this process? Well, I would like to reframe it a bit because I see myself as a scholar. So I would ask a question: what's the role of a critical legal scholar in this process, and how we should understand the production and use generation of these indicators? And I suppose that my answer would be to use Anneli's Ryle's probably kind of method, just to take them and unpack them and to see how they work in practice. Today we've heard many kind of suggestions of regulating indicators, also thinking about accountability, thinking about inadequacy and inaccuracy of indicators. I think that what I want to maybe suggest, and maybe we could also talk about this today, that this is not the only way of looking at indicators and seeing. Well, I would like to disengage in this debate of even thinking about a possibility of measuring, of a possibility thinking of adequacy, because that assumes a possibility of objectivity, of that we can measure, that we want to measure, that we want to see the world through the lenses of statistical representation. So I guess that my question would be, instead of dividing and seeing indicators as being technical or political or social or economic, see them as all socially constructed, because they are socially constructed and they embed different assumptions about the way we understand our society, the way we understand our economy and just life generally. I think that the distinction that we're trying to make sometimes of a scientific indicator, technical, it doesn't really help us to understand how they operate. So, thank you.
Okay, I think that Sabino was...
I want to react to your comment. I see a danger. The danger is to consider the development of indicators at the global level as part of the what I would call the dream of science in government. It's a chapter of a long history which goes back to James Landis' administrative process, which reflects the scientific management revolution. Now, we must be clear that indicators are slippery, they must be interpreted like norms, and therefore that they are part of politics. Let me give you one example. I was many years ago part of the machinery of the doing business affair, and they asked me, is the legal Italian legal order competition oriented or not? And they based their indicators on my perception or perception of many other people in this country. So they are very slippery. So they are part of politics, and therefore we cannot put them into this long history of what I call the dream of science in government.
Okay. Are there any other reactions or need to answer by me? No. So we could close this two interesting sessions of this afternoon. I think it was very useful, this type of seminar. And at this point, we can reconvene tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.